Chapter 40. We spent 3 weeks with the Chichituk on the frozen world of Sol Draconi Septim, and in that time we rested, recovered, wandered the frozen tunnels of their frozen atmosphere with them, learned a few words and phrases of their difficult language, visited Father Glaucus in the embedded city, stalked and were stalked by Arctic wraiths, and made that final, terrible trek downriver. But I am getting ahead of myself. It is easy to do, to rush the tale, especially with the probability increasing of inhaling cyanide on the next breath I take. But enough. This story will end abruptly when I do, not before. And it matters little if it is here or there or in between. I will tell it, as if I shall be allowed to tell it all. Our first glimpse of the Chichituk almost ended in tragedy for both sides. We had doused our hand lamps and were crouching in the weighted darkness of that ice corridor, my plasma rifle charged and ready, when the dimmest of lights appeared at the next bend in the tunnel and large, inhuman shapes ambled around the corner. I flicked on my hand lamp, and its cold, dulled beam illuminated a terrifying sight. 3 or 4 broad beasts, white fur, black claws the length of my hand, white teeth that were even longer, reddish glowing eyes. The creatures moved in a fog of their own breath. I raised the plasma rifle to my shoulder and clicked the select to rapid fire.
"Don't shoot!" cried Anea, grabbing my arm. "They're human!"
Her cry stayed not only my hand, but that of the Chichituk. Long bone spears had appeared from the folds of white fur, and our lamp beams illuminated sharpened points and pale arms pulled back to hurl them. But Anea's voice seemed to freeze the tableau, with both sides a muscle's twitch away from violence. I then saw the pale faces beneath the visors of wraith teeth. Broad faces, blunt-nosed, wrinkled, pale to the point of albinoism, but all too human, as were the dark eyes that gleamed back at us. I lowered the light so that it was not in their eyes. The Chichituk were broad and muscular, well adapted to Sol Draconi Septim's punishing 1.7 Gs, and they looked even wider and more powerful with the layers of wraith furs wrapped around them so. We were soon to learn that they each wore the forward half of the animal's hide, including its head, so the black wraith claws hung below their hands, the wraith teeth covering their faces, like a dagger-sharp portcullis. We also learned that the wraith's black eye lenses, even without the complicated optics and nerves that allowed the monsters to see in almost total darkness, still worked like simple night vision goggles. Everything the Chichituk wore and were carrying had come from the wraiths. Bone spears, rawhide thongs made from wraith gut and tendon, their water bags formed from tied-off wraith intestines, their sleeping robes and pallets, even the 2 artifacts they carried with them, the mitre-shaped brazier fashioned from wraith bone, carried on rawhide thongs which held the glowing embers that lighted their way, and the more complicated bone bowl and funnel, which melted the ice to water over the brazier. We did not know until later that their already ample bodies looked broader and lumpier because of the water bags they carried under their robe, using their body heat to keep the water liquid. The standoff must have held for a full minute and a half before Anea stepped forward on our side and the Chichituk we later knew as Kuchiat stepped forward toward us. Kuchiat spoke first, a torrent of harsh noises sounding like nothing so much as great icicles crashing to a hard surface.
"I'm sorry," said Anea. "I don't understand."
She looked back at us. I looked at A. Betic. "Do you recognize this dialect?"
Web English had been the standard for so many centuries that it was almost shocking to hear words that bore no meaning. Even 3 centuries after the fall, according to the off-worlders who had come through Hyperion, most planetary and regional dialects were still understandable.
"No, I do not," said A. Betic.
"Emendymion, if I might suggest, the comm log." I nodded and retrieved the bracelet from my pack. The Chichituk watched warily, still speaking among themselves, eyes alert for a weapon. Their spear arms relaxed as I raised the bangle to eye level and pressed it on.
"I am activated and awaiting your question or command," chirped the ice-frosted bracelet.
"Listen," I said as Chuchiat began speaking again. "Tell me if you can translate this." The wraith-garbed warrior made a short, crashing speech.
"Well," I said to the comm log.
"This language or dialect is not familiar," chimed the ship's voice from the comm log. "I am familiar with several old Earth languages, including pre-Web English, German, French, Dutch, Japanese."
"Never mind," I said.
The Chichituk were staring at the babbling comm log. But there was no fear or superstition visible in those large dark eyes that peered from between wraith teeth. Only curiosity.
"I would suggest," continued the comm log, "that you keep me activated for some weeks or months while this language is being spoken. I could then collect a database from which a simple lexicon could be constructed. It might also be preferable to..."
"Thanks anyway," I said and pressed it off.
Ania took a step closer to Kuchiat and pantomimed our being cold and tired. She made gestures for food, pulling a blanket over us and sleep. Kuchiat grunted and conferred with the others. There were 7 of the Chichituk crowding the ice tunnel now, and we were to learn that their hunting parties always traveled in prime numbers, as did their larger bands. Finally, after speaking separately to each of his men, Kuchiat spoke to us briefly, turned back up the ascending corridor, and gestured for us to follow. Shivering, bent under the weight of the world's gravity, straining to see by their dim ember light after we had switched off our hand lamps to conserve the batteries, making sure that my inertial compass was working, leaving its digital trail of crumbs behind as we walked, we followed Kuchiat and his men toward the Chichituk camp. They were a generous people. They gave us each a wraith robe to wear, more hind robes to sleep in and on, wraith broth heated over their little brazier, water from their body-heated bags, and their trust. The Chichituk, we soon learned, did not war among themselves. The thought of killing another human was alien to them. Essentially, the Chichituk, indigenes who had been adapting to the ice for almost 1,000 years, were the only survivors of the fall, the viral plagues, and the wraiths. The Chichituk took everything they needed from the monstrous wraiths, and, from what we could glean, the wraiths depended solely upon the Chichituk for their own food. All other life forms, always marginal, had fallen below the survival threshold after the fall and the failure of terraforming. Our first couple of days with them were spent sleeping, eating, and trying to communicate. The Chichituk had no permanent villages in the ice. They would sleep for a few hours, fold their robes, and move on through the warren of tunnels. When heating ice to water, their only use of fire since the embers were not enough to warm them and they ate their meat raw. They suspended the miter brazier from the ice ceiling with 3 wraith tendon thongs so that it would not leave a telltale melted point in the ice. There were 23 of them in the tribe, band, clan, whatever you could call them. And at first it was not possible to tell if there were any females among them. The Chichituk seemed to wear their robes at all times, just lifting them enough to avoid soiling them while urinating or defecating in one of the ice fissures. It was not until we saw the woman named Chachia mating with Kuchiat in our 3rd sleep period that we were sure that females were in the band. Slowly, as we walked and talked with them through the never-changing dimness of tunnels over the next 2 days, we began to learn their faces and names. Kuchiat, the leader, was, despite the avalanche of his voice, a gentleman, given to smiling with both his thin lips and his black eyes. Chaku, his second in command, was the tallest of the band and wore a wraith robe with a streak of blood on it, which we later realized was a mark of honor. Aichikut was the angry one, often scowling at us and always keeping his distance. I think that if Aichikut had been leader of the hunting band when we'd encountered them, there would have been dead bodies in the ice that day. Kuchtu was, we thought, a sort of medicine man, and it was his job to circle the ice niche or tunnel where we slept, muttering incantations and removing his wraith-leather gloves to press his bare palms against the ice. It was my guess that he was driving away bad spirits. Anea suggested wryly that he might just be doing what we were, trying to find a way out of this ice maze. Chichtiku was the fire carrier, and obviously proud of having attained that honor. The embers were a mystery to us. They continued to glow and give off heat and light for days, weeks, yet were never stoked or renewed. It was not until we met Father Glaucus that this puzzle was cleared up. There were no children with the band, and it was hard to tell the ages of the Chichituk we got to know. Kuchiat was obviously older than most. His face was a web of wrinkles, radiating from the bridge of that wide blade of a nose. But we never succeeded in discussing ages with any of them. They recognized Anea as a child, or at least a young adult, and treated her accordingly. The women, we noticed after identifying three of them as such, carried out the role of hunter and sentry in equal rotation with the men. Although they were to honor Abetic and me with the job of standing guard while the band slept, three people with weapons were always left awake. They never asked Anea to perform that chore. But they obviously enjoyed her and enjoyed talking with her, everyone using the combination of simple words and elaborate signs that have served to bridge the gap between peoples since the Paleolithic. On the third day, Anea succeeded in asking them to return to the river with us. At first they were puzzled, but her signs and the few words she had picked up soon communicated the concept. The river, the raft floating, the arch of the Farcaster frozen in ice. They exclaimed at this. Then the ice wall and our walking up the ice tunnel before meeting our friends, the Chichituk. When Anea suggested that we return to the river together, the band gathered up the sleeping robes, stuffed them into the wraith-hide packs, and were marching with us within moments. For once I led the way, the glowing dial of the inertial compass unraveling the many twists, turns, ascents, and descents we had taken in our 3 days of wandering. I should say here that if it had not been for our chronometers, time would have disappeared in the ice tunnels of Sol Draconi Septim. The unchanging dim glow from the bone brazier, the glint of ice walls, the darkness ahead of us and behind, the impressing cold, the short sleep periods and endless hours of laboring up icy corridors with the weight of the planet on our backs, everything combined to destroy our sense of time. But according to the chronometer, it was late on the third day since abandoning the raft that we descended the last bit of narrow corridor and returned to the river. It was a sad sight. The splintered foremast and battered logs, the stern of the craft almost submerged from a buildup of ice, the lanterns we had left behind coated white with frost, and the entire vessel looking empty and forlorn without our tent and gear. The Chichituk were fascinated, showing the most animation we had seen from them since our initial encounter. Using lines of braided wraith hide, Kuchiat and several of the others lowered themselves to the raft and examined every detail carefully. The stone of our abandoned hearth, the metal of the lanterns, the nylon line used to lash the logs. Their excitement was tangible, and I realized that in a society where the only source of building material, weaponry, and clothing came from a single animal, a skillful predator at that, the raft must represent a treasure trove of raw material. They could have attempted to kill or abandon us then and taken that wealth. But the Chichituk were a generous people, and not even greed could alter their view that all humans were allies, just as all wraiths were enemies and prey. We had not seen a wraith at that time, except, of course, for the skins we wore over our tropical clothing, since the robes were so incredibly warm, rivaling the thermal blanket for insulative efficiency, that we were able to pack away most of the outer layers we had bundled on. But if we were innocent of the wraith's power and hunger then, we would not stay so innocent for long. Once again, Ania communicated the idea of our floating downriver through the arch. She pantomimed the ice wall, pointed to it, and then showed them our continued trip downriver to the second arch. This got Kuchiat and his band even more animated, and they tried to talk to us without sign language, their harsh words and sentences falling on us like a load of gravel dumped at our ears. When that failed, they turned and talked excitedly to one another. Finally, Kuchiat stepped forward and spoke a short sentence to the three of us. We heard the word Glaucus repeated. We had heard it before in their speeches, the word standing out as alien to their language. And when Kuchiat gestured upward and repeated the sign for all of us walking up toward the surface, we eagerly agreed. And thus it was, each of us swathed in robes of wraith fur, our backs hunched against the weight of our packs in the exhausting gravity, our feet scrabbling on rock-hard ice, that we set out toward the ice-buried city to meet the priest.